Goldman.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, Michael Wigmore for Petitioners Medical Waste Institute and Energy Recovery Council. With me at council table today is Sandra Franco of my office and Ron Shipley for intervener CRWI. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Petitioners, well, wish you luck on that, Counsel.
Petitioners challenge EPA standards, revised standards for medical waste incinerators on three grounds. We ask that the court vacate those standards. First, EPA's methodology uses a MACT-on-MACT approach where it utilizes post-MACT compliance data from the 1997 standards in order to recalculate the floors for new and existing units. And within those...
What would you have had them done instead?
What I would have had them done is do what they did in the 2007 proposal, which is the petitioners never argue that the agency is precluded from resetting the MAC floor. What petitioners argue is they cannot use post-MAC compliance data in doing
so. What data would they use?
Well, they had data. What EPA argues is they had data from the existing units that survived after 98% of the units shut down. They had data from 52 existing units that were in existence at the time. And under Sierra Club and CKRC, the agency can use any data available to it that reasonably estimates the actual performance. But in this case, what's critical is the agency used the post-MAC compliance data to reset the floors. And in doing so, it reset floors for existing units using data from units that were subject to the 1997 new source performance standard. Those were new units.
Are you talking about the 52 now?
Five out of the 57 units that were in existence that EPA used for purposes of its final rule were new units under the 1997 standards. Mm-hmm. And so in recalculating the floors for existing units, the agency used data from five what had previously been defined as new units in an attempt to recalculate the floor
You would have had them do what? Use just the 52?
Yes. What they did in the 2007 proposal was that EPA only used data from the 52 units that were in existence at the time and tried to come up with a methodology that reasonably estimated.
And the five other units, the ones to which you object, came on stream during what period?
They came on stream after the 19, all through the early 2000s. I don't have the exact dates, but because they were
new relative to the 1997
correct.
Performance data.
And they were
but
built.
They, at some point, new things become existing things. And when they go back and revisit the floor, why shouldn't they take into account all 57?
We argue that the agency cannot go back and actually reset the floor. We're saying that they can use the data from those new units. But what the statute...
Well, to do what then?
To go beyond the floor, to determine what the statute contemplates is setting the floor a single time, because once the agency then Once it's set a floor.
They hadn't set a valid floor a single time.
Well, they argue they haven't set a valid floor a single time.
Well, we told them they hadn't.
Mm-hmm. What the court said at the time is the agency hadn't adequately explained it, but that still, it had a sufficient data available to it to recalculate the floor based on the units that were available at that time. Under the statute, once the agency sets a floor to go either beyond the floor or to do a five-year review, it is required to take into consideration costs, energy impacts, non-air quality, health, environmental impacts. All those factors are
inconsistent. Back up to earlier in that sentence when you said once the agency has set the floor. The agency had not validly set the floor, right? The agency has only set the floor once now.
Well, but in doing so.
They tried to once before.
The agent, that's
we great. Told them they hadn't. So they've now still only set the floor one time, right?
But in doing so, what happened was now the agency has waited on the these standards went into effect.
We didn't vacate the floor.
You did not vacate the floor. That's true.
But we invalidated it.
You said that EPA had not adequately explained it and remanded it to the agency.
The point was that if they didn't, we would have to vacate it.
Yeah.
Right? But we left it in place so they could get on with at least this much of their program.
That's correct. But then what happens is the agency on the remand never addresses the remand. And so these units are still subject to these standards to this day. So the agency waits 12 years. You have five new units that are constructed to the NSPS.
They gave up on using the old data and gave a reason for why they gave up, right?
That's correct. And they switched their positions between the 2007 proposal and the 2008 re-proposal, arguing that while the 2007 proposal would have reset the floor based on data from the existing units and used the new source units only to go beyond the floor, the agency somehow argues that using new units constructed after those standards went into effect, became enforceable, allowed the agency to reasonably calculate what could be achieved by sources in 1997. But those sources weren't in existence in 1997. The agency had available to it. In fact, when 98% of the industry shut down, what was left was essentially all the best performing units. So the agency ran the MACT floor exercise once. It resulted in the shutdown of 98% of the industry. And then with just those 57 units left, all of which, frankly, reflect the best performers from prior to 1997, the agency ran it again. So now you've got the best performing 12% of the remaining 2% of units and has managed to set a floor that the agency admits will result in the elimination of this industry. And if the court finds that the statute is not clear on this point, we believe that even under Chevron 2, EPA's methodology should be invalidated because simply by setting a floor, which is supposed to reflect the minimum level of stringency for a max standard, in just going through the floor exercise here, the agency has come up with standards that it admits will eliminate an industry, and it has done so without any consideration of risk. The risk from these facilities could be well within the benzene acceptable range. They could be negligible. The agency does not know.
Let me hear
that.
That
is not what Congress intended.
Eliminate an industry. Are you saying that this will be completely shut down as an industry because of this?
Well, that's what EPA says. I mean, EPA says it assumes that no new units will be built, and all the existing units will eventually go out of business, and this is for an industry that, and again, without any consideration of risk, and it's for an industry where a number of states require incineration of these types of materials specifically to protect human health and the environment. EPA has admitted that certain types of waste have to be treated with this technology.
So because it's highly unlikely that the industry is actually going to completely vanish, right?
Well, it's the agency and it's...
Never mind what the agency assumes. They assume that for some purposes, okay. But well, the agency, there is... no reason for us to operate on a legally significant assumption that the industry is going to vanish.
Well, that's what the agency said in the record.
I'll take that as a no, since I can't get
it. Well, that's the one thing we agree. Well, I agree with you. I mean, frankly, if you're looking, yeah,
now,
we
you
agree with the agency.
Using that 2% figure about what remains from the industry, the 98%. Uh-huh. In fact, that 2% of units processed right at 20% of the total process. But before the enactment did.
Right. Well, what happened was you saw a switch from a tremendous number of small units shut down and a smaller percentage of large units shut down. But still, from the time of the standards, at the time of the standards, there are 460, depending upon how you calculate EPA's numbers, between 460 and 480 existing large units. And after the standards, as of today, there are only 36. So you still said, lost more than 90% of the large units.
You said that the that they shut down because of the 1997
That's right.
standards. And what's your support for that?
Well, again, EPA presumes that the 1990 in promulgating the 1997 standard, the agency assumed that the units would shut down instead of trying to meet the stringency of the standard.
If the 1997 standards had been vacated in 1999, would a different number have shut down? And what's your support for whatever your answer is on that?
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the agency would have you believe that it was, you know, like a Y2K issue, that all of a sudden around the turn of the century, you know, 98% of a previously, 3,000 units decided to shut down. The reason was, is
you're
the agency...
saying, okay, so your support for that is basically common sense. If the standards hadn't been in place, then maybe some would have shut down, but not nearly as many.
That's right, I'll have to find the site to it, but EPA in the 1997 rule presumes that the stringent nature of the standards is going to require that most units will shut down. That's in the record, and we agree with that as well.
What's your position on the 2007 proposal?
We think the 2007 proposal was consistent with the statute. What the agency did is it used data that from units existing at the time when it set the floor in order to respond to the court's remand and accurately estimate the actual performance of units at the time. It did not incorporate the NSPS units into that determination. It used the NSPS units for purposes of going beyond the floor to determine whether further reductions were achievable.
And One more question along these lines. Suppose that they had been vacated in 1999, and it took, by our court, and then it took EPA until 2008 to come up with a floor. Any legal problem there?
No. Because we wouldn't have been subject to the standards. I mean, this industry has been subject to these standards for close to a decade now and has had to comply with them. And the agency claims that it didn't reset the floors based on the 1997 standards, but it's clear by incorporating new units in setting the floors that it did so.
Well, but I'm either not following Judge Kavanaugh's question completely or you're not following it completely. Suppose that the last time this was up here, instead of leaving them in place and sending them back on remand, we had vacated and remanded. And right. Then the agency had adopted a rule that incorporated units which had been placed online in the interim. Would that have been legal?
Yes, because there would not have been an enforceable standard at the time to which the units would have had to have been built.
But there was not a valid, completely valid standard in effect at the time they did it now, right?
It was an enforceable regulation. It's still an enforceable regulation to this day, and these units are subject to that.
This may illustrate why Judge Randolph and I every now and then write one of these grumbling concurrences or dissents that says we really shouldn't be remanding without vacating.
Yeah, the fundamental problem here, as you can tell from my questions, from my perspective, is remanding without vacator leaves a regulatory uncertainty and uncertainty for the industry, and it's created a host
That's
of problems.
That's not your fault.
That's not your fault.
That's not even the agency's fault.
Yes.
All right, if I could, I'd like to move on to the pollutant by pollutant.
Well, the agency didn't have to sit on it for 10 years.
That's the agency's fault, yeah.
The result of which maybe this doesn't happen again.
Yeah.
Again, I'd like to move on to the pollutant by pollutant issue. And again, we believe this is a Chevron 1 issue that in setting MAC floors based on the what has been achieved in practice by the best performing similar unit, the statute means exactly what it says. That for new units, and as this court has recognized in both Sierra Club and CKRC, the use of the singular in the statute seems to suggest that the agency should look to the single best performing unit. What the floor is, it's simply a limitation on EPA's discretion to determine what is achievable. And the intent is to look at real units and what they actually achieve in practice and make sure that all existing sources and all new sources for the best performing similar unit come up to that level. But then if the agency wishes to go beyond that level, again, it has to consider the statutory factors. And by imposing a pollutant-by-pollutant approach here, the agency is not looking at what has actually been achieved in practice by any source.
What reason is there to think, I didn't see you're offering one, but I may have missed it, that if two different units can achieve compliance with different standard, one with standard A for a particular pollutant and one with standard B for a different pollutant, that there's some fundamental incompatibility that would prevent A from achieving or B from achieving both standards?
Well, there's not the issue is whether or not that's considered in the context of the floor, reflecting what has been achieved in practice versus what the agency believes may be achievable. But to go to that second step.
Is this just a restatement of the first argument, but more as an arbitrary and capricious matter?
No, it's a separate. The first argument was MACT on MACT, which was it took post-MACT compliance data to recalculate the floors. Here, the statute says that the agency has to base the floor on what has been achieved in practice. So, for instance, for large units, the, quote, best performing similar unit was, in fact, a hypothetical amalgamation of five different units using different control
techniques. So is there some reason to believe? You're standing on the statutory term. I'm asking a practical question. There's some reason to believe that it's not achievable or that it's unreasonable for the agency to think that Unit A will and Unit B can achieve both standards since they've achieved one and the others achieved the other standard.
Well, but the agency hasn't looked at that issue in the context of this rule because the 2009 rule was promulgated solely on the floor, which is supposed to reflect what's achieved in practice. Now, that's the agency's response. The agency's response is, well, we don't believe that utilization of different control technologies cause any conflicts, or as the industry argued, you have inverse relationships between certain pollutants, where if you try and control for CO, NOx goes up, you control for NOx, CO goes up, and there's a balance there. But the agency looks at each one of those individually and says, meet it all. But that's never been achieved in practice. And the agency's response is, well, if you can't meet it, add on additional pollution controls like selective non-catalytic reduction. Well, none of the best performing units have selective non-catalytic reduction. It's never been achieved in practice. These are 111 standards. It's not a control technology that's been adequately demonstrated. And if the agency wants an industry, if it wants to go beyond the floor and require an industry to install additional pollution controls, it can do so, but it has to consider the factors under the statute. What the agency
Why wasn't this all equally true in the 1997 rule?
Because the agency was setting floor, as we point out, the agency was setting floors in an entirely different manner.
But it was requiring, was it not, that each unit achieve all of the standards?
That's right, but it was setting floors based on what the agency argued that the floors themselves had to be achievable. And we're not saying the agency can consider a pollutant-by-pollutant approach in determining what is achievable. But that's for going beyond the floor and for purposes of five-year review. The statute says the floor has to be set based on what is achieved in practice. And so you have, again, for medium units, the best performing similar new unit is an amalgamation of eight different units, each setting a different floor, and the agency acknowledges that the methodology results in no existing medium units that have ever met the floor. And that can't be what Congress intended.
I'm certain that I understand your Chevron 1 argument. What is it about the language of the statute that conclusively precludes the use of the pollutant by pollutant approach?
Achieved in practice by the best performing similar source. That's the new uniform.
That does not say best performing similar source with reference to all pollutants or pollutant by pollutant.
But if you do
isn't that classic Chevron ambiguity?
Well, we think it's a Chevron.
I wasn't here for the oral argument on Chevron. I wasn't in the Supreme Court for that. But when they're talking about source, each side, I think, was fairly certain that source meant point source or source meant zone source.
Right.
Best performing existing unit means as to all pollutants or to one pollutant.
But even if the court determines that it's ambiguous and it's a Chevron 2 issue, here the agency's interpretation is unreasonable because, again, the methodology that it that it undertakes in interpreting that ambiguity results in standards that have never been achieved by any unit and can't be, you know, the agency admits, cannot be achieved without, for at least for medium units, without the installation of additional controls, without considering the factors necessary for beyond the floor. And ultimately, it's for the same reason we talked about in the MACT on MACT, it results in standards that is going to put an industry out of business based on an exercise that is simply supposed to reflect the minimum level of stringency.
Respondent says you coined the term MACT on MACT. Did you coin that term, counsel?
I don't know that I can take credit for it. I mean, there's no dispute factually as to what occurred here. What occurred is the agency used post-MACT compliance data in order to reset the floor, including post-MACT compliance data for new units, to reset the floor for existing units. So, you know, our argument is that the statute does not allow for that, that you cannot ratchet an industry down twice because you're going to end up with this result. And the agency, if it can do it here, can do it to any industry because it's none of the standards.
That doesn't follow. They could do it here if they did it because we remanded without vacatur.
Well, I mean,
if it had been vacated, they couldn't have done it, could they?
Well, no. I mean, the agency claims it has the authority to do so.
You wouldn't have the same complaint. They could have done it, but you wouldn't have the same complaint. There wouldn't be MACT on MACT in your term.
That's right. It depends upon how they do it. I mean, if there is an existing MACT.
If we had vacated, so there was not.
That's right. If you had vacated, there was not an existing standard, then it would not have been MACT on MACT because those units wouldn't have had to comply. It would have been the first time the agency went through the floor setting. If I may just discuss briefly the SSM issue. The petitioner's challenge.
Very quick. You are out of time. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. The agency, we challenge this on both procedural and substantive grounds. On procedural grounds, the agency knowingly violated the notice requirements under the Clean Air Act and notwithstanding decided to go final with the rule. But we also challenge it on substantive grounds, namely that the agency, as this court has held in Northeast Maryland, the agency has an affirmative duty to promulgate a non-arbitrary, non-capricious rule. And here, by withdrawing the rule of the SSM exemption in its entirety, the agency makes two arguments. Number one, the agency argues that the exemption is of no utility.
Is it properly before us?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Is it properly before us?
Yes, I do believe it's properly. But, well, certainly on the issues, petitioners specifically commented that in the record, and that is at JA 815, note 23, The SSM decision came out during the public comment period, the second public comment period, and petitioners explicitly noted that that decision was rendered under 112, that it didn't affect 111 and 129 standards. In the Kushner memo, which is at JA 1001, the agency discusses the effects of the SSM decision. Nowhere does it mention 111 or 129.
So did that you issue raise the objection with specifics?
Yes, we did. On that issue, the issues
where,
that we,
where did you raise it with sufficient specificity?
On those two points, it's in our comments. It's at JA 815. Now, the agency notes that other parties raised it.
In the footnote.
In the footnote.
Well, at the time, frankly, it was never noticed, and it frankly warranted no more than a footnote because the agency had never put anybody on notice that it was intending to apply this rule or this ruling to 111 sources. And
your
if I may
time
just.
Time is more than up, so unless my colleagues.
I do have one question. Okay. When the agency came out with this rule, mm-hmm. It was then open for you to seek reconsideration because of this problem, right?
It was, but what that effectively, if the court rewards the agency, or the agency knowingly, the agency knew it didn't provide notice. There are numerous other instances in this record where the agency declined to go final on an issue because it had not provided notice. And here, the agency knowingly violated the notice requirement and is seeking to have this court insulate that decision from review. And if the court allows the agency to do that.
Reconsideration was required, they are insulated. Since you didn't seek it, so that's the question.
But this is an instance where, as Judge Williams said, the statutory to interpret it that way, the statute either can't mean what it says, or it requires judicial surgery because Congress could not have intended to allow the agency to knowingly violate a notice and comment requirement and go final on a rule and not have that issue be reviewable, because it renders notice and comment illusory. The agency can do it anytime it's expedient to do so.
The statute provides for reconsideration, and I think requires it when the agency has put out something that wasn't subject to comment.
What happens is, it's a strategic decision to violate the statute. What happens is, you file a petition for reconsideration, and then the agency, in this instance, when it ever gets around to it, it'll grant it, and at that point come up with a rationale for what it did. And as this court has held.
That's the purpose of it, isn't it?
Well, no. With this court, in Kennecott, this court held that the availability of a petition for reconsideration is not a substitute for the agency providing for notice and comment.
But if you had sought reconsideration and put in information about why the exemption really is significant and important to the industry, and the agency had come up with, as you said, mm-hmm. some justification, that would be subject to
subject to review is the agency's reconsideration decision, not the original decision to just pull it without any notice or comment at all. That's what then becomes subject to review. So the agency's conscious decision to violate the statute here never becomes subject to review.
You give no role whatsoever to a petition for reconsideration.
No, that's not. I believe you're
right. You're saying we don't have to do it because if we do, they're liable to give an explanation.
No, only. But
isn't
only,
that why we have it in part?
But only. I'm only saying that it does not serve a role when the agency looks at an issue and makes a conscious decision to violate the notice requirements. If this were an APA case, it's clear there's lack of adequate notice. But the agency is construing the Clean Air Act somehow to allow it to consciously violate the act and nonetheless go final.
Well, they appeared to have, they expressed the view and appear to have been of the impression that the exemption was not important. And
well,
so
that's,
they went ahead
that's
and
why,
did this saying it's not important only to find out that it's very important.
Well, if the agency had provided notice, as we argue, we do challenge, not only on procedural grounds, but also on substantive grounds. The agency's determination was of no utility holds for startup and shutdown because these units do not combust any waste during startup and shutdown. But they do combust waste during malfunctions. And while even though the agency claimed that it's of no utility during malfunctions, there's record evidence that the industry does use this exemption during malfunctions.
What prevented you from calling up a motion for potential reconsideration to raise precisely that?
Well, because we object to the fact that the agency just pulled this out without providing any
notice. How did that keep you from filing a petition for reconsideration?
It didn't. We just don't believe that it applies in this instance because it allows the agency to render the notice and comment illusory because it can disregard its notice and comment.
I think your exception just ate the rule, counsel. Anytime a petitioner fails to make that petition, they can say exactly what you just said.
Well, not unless there's record evidence that the agency knowingly violated the statute. And then just following up with Judge Ginsburg, the other...
Unless he wants you to, your time is up. You want to follow
last
up?
Last point, yeah, last time.
The other issue is that we also challenge it, again, on substantive grounds because it's arbitrary and capricious, because the rule ends up, the way the agency, by pulling the SSM exemption, these units will now be... are presumed to violate the emission standards for six different pollutants during a time period when the agency claims that it should not be possible to exceed the limits. So the rule is arbitrary and capricious. Putting aside the procedural requirements, the rule itself is arbitrary and capricious because the agency's determination.
For lack of exemption,
I'm sorry?
For lack of the exemption, for malfunction.
That's right, for lack of any exemption because you're presumed to violate the standard when the agency says it's not possible.
I think we have the argument. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from the respondent. Good morning, Mr. Rosen.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. With me at counsel's table is Mike Thrift from EPA and Jim Pugh from the interveners, who will take 5 minutes of our time. As in most of these cases, the case starts and ends essentially with the statute. Section 129A2 requires EPA to set standards on the maximum degree of reduction of air pollutants listed under Section A4. Maximum degree of the reduction of air pollutants. It requires at the very least, at the very minimum, it set a floor based on the emissions controls achieved in practice, actually achieved by the best controlled units as determined by the administrator. The statute goes on to say that that shall include in determining these standards methods or technologies for removal or destruction of pollutants before, during, or after, meaning waste segregation and those types of issues, removal of waste before the combustion process as opposed to stack controls. As the Sierra Club case said, what this really means is that the standard has to be based on the units with the lowest emission levels. EPA made an initial
actually
attempt.
Achieved.
I'm sorry?
Actually achieved.
Actually achieved, yes. EPA made an initial attempt to do that in 1997. There was a severe lack of data, 7 out of 3,000 so units. So EPA used a surrogate, which this court said as a general matter it may use, but it has said in several cases that surrogate has to reflect the actual levels achieved. And as Judge Sentell said in the Northeast case, there has to be substantial evidence that it does that. Well, EPA got it wrong, as this court aptly described in its 1999 case. So EPA tried again, and after the remand, EPA, with data now existing, it became fairly straightforward. Set the best achieved limits on what's actually being achieved by the actual units out there. There's no dispute about what EPA did. The dispute is that whether after a remand, EPA is required to go back in time and base emission levels on the same incomplete and erroneous information it had in 1997. Do petitioners have an entitlement to go back in time to 1997?
Are you generally entitled to reset the floor?
Is EPA entitled to reset the floor? EPA is obligated to.
No, outside the context of this case, once a floor has been set, can EPA reset it in the 5 years, 10 years later?
Well, certainly if EPA believes there's an error, even if not told by this court that it's an error, if EPA determines on its own it has set those floors in error or improperly or based on incomplete data, it certainly has that right. Beyond that, we believe EPA
does.
So
even outside the context of the 5 year revision, EPA can at any time for any industry reset the floors.
Absolutely, as the cases many cases we listed in our brief, unless there's a specific prohibition against that in the statute, EPA can do that.
Is your source of authority for that 7129 or is it 7411? 111.
It's 129, but it's the case law which makes clear that EPA can always go back and correct its errors.
What about 111B1B? Why isn't that applicable here?
Well, I believe it's applicable, but I don't believe there's anything in there that restricts EPA from correcting.
On the contrary, it seems to authorize you to do what you did.
It
seems to authorize the sort of thing you just did.
Which is correct the floors.
It says, when implementation and enforcement of any requirement of this chapter, same chapter as 129, mm-hmm. include the emission indicate that emission limitations and percent reductions beyond those required by the standards promulgated under this section are achieved in practice. The administrator shall, when revising standards promulgated under this section, consider the limitations and percent reductions achieved in practice. Now it says when revising, so you still have to have a basis for revising.
Yes.
But you claim a basis here.
Yes.
This would seem to say, when you do that, look at what's been achieved.
I believe that's right, Your Honor. I believe under either statute, you go based on what has been achieved.
So once
the petitioners say, well, no one unit's achieved all of these standards.
Well, that's not accurate, and it doesn't matter.
The second answer first, if you would. Tell us why it doesn't matter.
Because this is determined on a pollutant-by-pollutant basis. It always has been from 1997. So EPA could, let's put aside the actual facts for a second. EPA could go unit by unit and say, here's the best one for PM, here's the best one for dioxin, here's the best one for mercury. You have to put in the controls to reach those levels.
Now,
the fact that
somebody can win, pitching, win 20 baseball games in a season, and another player can bat 350, doesn't mean that there must be somebody out there who can do both, let alone everybody.
He did. Hey, Bruce,
Right. let alone everybody being required to do both.
It doesn't mean there must be that, no. And we say there needn't be
one. You're saying to each of them, you better do both.
That's right, because the statute specifically requires that the maximum reduction reach.
Well, raise the numbers so that it's never been done by any one person.
Yeah, that is incorrect. It has been done.
Okay,
and it's in the record that EPA determined in response to comments, not because this is the basis to do it, but in response to comments that there are units out there that have reached all nine of the new levels.
Simultaneously.
Not for the medium, but at least for the small and large. And others don't have far to go.
How many have done that?
I believe at least four on the large, and I can't recall how many on the small. But again, that doesn't matter, because if there's ones that have reached five or six or seven, they need to do whatever is necessary, waste segregation, combustion conditions, or put in new stack controls to reach the levels on the other. And EPA found there was no inconsistency. There were comments raised in the record that, well, wait a minute, we don't think we can do that because it's impossible to do. Well, first of all, it's not impossible to do because it's already been done by some of these units. But secondly, there was no evidence in the record that by reducing certain pollutants, it would increase other pollutants. EPA asked for it and found nothing in the record to do that. And as far as the pollutant-by-pollutant approach, while we're on it, there is no jurisdiction for this court to address that issue. That issue was decided in 1997. That issue was not the subject of the remand in 1999. Questions about the pollutant-by-pollutant approach were raised in the comments in 1997. And EPA applied that. That was a settled area. This court has said a number of times in all the reopener cases, there are settled areas in a regulation and there are unsettled areas. If EPA consciously addresses an area, that's unsettled. That can be readdressed. But if it's a settled matter that it's not going back to, then it cannot be brought before this court. It's more than 60 days after 1997 when that issue was brought before the court. There's simply no jurisdiction here. I believe the petitioners raised in the reply brief, which shouldn't be before this court, constructive reopener. That is when there's a huge sea change that occurs that couldn't have been anticipated. That's not the case here. A, there was no sea change. It was pollutant by pollutant in 1997, and it's pollutant by pollutant in 2009.
But the stakes have changed.
The stakes have not changed at all, Your Honor, because according to petitioners, 98% of the industry disappeared as a result of that 1997 regulation. If that's not high enough stakes, then what is? And that was not a surprise to petitioners, because EPA warned.
It didn't attack the pollutant by pollutant approach in 97.
I'm sorry?
It didn't attack the pollutant by pollutant approach. Is that
not
right?
In court. No.
Okay. So, and then the result is that 98% of the industry say disappears. And so now it's apparent that any further increase will further diminish the numbers in the industry, something that wasn't apparent in 97, let's say. So why isn't it the case that the stakes appear to have changed based on experience? Who could have anticipated that 98% of the industry would disappear?
Petitioners could have, because they said it in the preamble of the 1997 rule. They said most of these, I think, as Mr. Wigmore said that, most of these entities are going to disappear, even when we're sending it at this inadequate level, because they have no controls whatsoever now. So any controls are going to cost
money. These on-site incinerators?
These are on-site incinerators. And there's a bit of a misnomer that there's this industry out there. These are not folks who are making money burning medical waste. These are hospitals in our neighborhoods who had the thing in their parking lot and were burning waste, and it was cheaper to do it other ways. It was cheaper to autoclave it, which is sterilize it, and send it to a landfill. So EPA determined and said in the 1997 preamble that most of these folks are going to disappear whatever standard we set, just because it's cheaper to do it otherwise, and this is not part of their business.
Presumably the throughput has not diminished significantly. It may have increased. So what's happening to it?
The
waste that has to be disposed.
The waste that has to be disposed is, as I say, being sterilized and sent to landfills. It's being sent to commercial.
It's not being sent to one of these 57 current operators?
The 57, the ones that continue to operate are Okay,
but they don't get it all. Some of it is going to where? To landfills?
To landfills, yes. It can be chemically treated. It can be sterilized. There are other ways to do this, which...
As opposed to being incinerated.
As opposed to being incinerated. That was just sort of the easy step there. As we turn back to the MACT on MACT, this is not MACT on MACT. It's a cute term, but it's just not accurate. There was no MACT. There was no maximum achieved control technology in 1997. It didn't comport with the statute.
Well, they were in effect, though.
They were in effect, yes. But
so
it wasn't was, MACT. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
If I can put it to you this way, let's say in 1997, EPA said what the court told us in 1999. This doesn't work. This surrogate just doesn't work. It's not based on real data. It doesn't include waste segregation. So EPA, it lacks data, but it has this obligation. What does it do? It sets forth a regulation that says we're going to do something temporary. We're going to do a half measure. We're going to set the standards based on compliance with state standards, which we know is not adequate, which we know it doesn't bring down to the maximum achieved. We're going to set it on these uncontrolled sources, which we know is not good enough. But that's what we've got now. But you know what? When we get the actual data, which is what this rule is supposed to be based on, then we'll revise the rule, and you'll have to meet those standards which finally comply with the statutory requirements.
But won't the actual data be based on a skewed pool that is different from the pool that would have existed as of 1997?
First of all, there's no prohibition against that. EPA made the determination that under its view, given the lack of data, the best set of data is the data of these facilities now. But secondly, I don't think it's skewed. When EPA looked at this, first of all, the 6%.
When I say skewed, what I mean is the fact that the 1997 standards stayed in effect created a different group of incinerators than if the 1997 standard had been vacated.
We don't think it did for setting the standards because for a couple of reasons. First of all, when we looked at it, two-thirds of the entities, I think we had data on 42 of the 57 entities, where we had data from 1995 as to what controls they were using in 2009. And two-thirds of those had exactly the same. So they didn't do anything to comply with those standards. So there is no MACT on MACT there. But the second point is when the standards were set in 1997, inadequate as they were, that they were based on the average of the 12%. That number is 144 units. 6% of the 24 units is 144 units. Yet we only ended up with 57 units. So even ones, 100 or so, that already met the inadequate 1997 standards, even they went out of business because they thought it was probably cheaper to do it otherwise. So it's a pretty good presumption that those 57 already complied, the 57 that decided to remain already complied with those standards. And so there's no real evidence in the record that the 57 that we based it on did anything to put in any kind of major controls to change that baseline. So we don't think it was MACT on MACT because it was never MACT to begin with, but we also don't think it was MACT on MACT because they put in any controls. And finally, there is no prohibition in the statute against doing it that way.
Concede that it would have simplified your life and ours if the EPA had acted a whole lot more with a whole lot more alacrity in responding to our remand.
I do concede that, but I think in the end it benefited petitioners because for 13 years they got to emit at levels that were way above the statutory standard. In conclusion, I'll just say this court has addressed this issue, as you well know, a number of times, including in the Brick case where I think
address it quickly because your time is up.
The finger of the court basically came out of its opinion and poked EPA in the chest. And
you won't say which finger.
That's right. And basically said, do it the way we've been telling you to do it for the last 10 years. Do it the way Congress told you you must do it. Thank you,
Your Honor. We'll hear from the intervener. Mr. Buehler.
Intervenor Sierra Club, NRDC. I'd like to address EPA's pollutant by pollutant approach very briefly. And first on that point, we agree with EPA that that issue is not properly before the court, both on reopener grounds and on waiver grounds. On the waiver issue, which of course no one has had a chance to brief because the whole issue came up in the reply brief, I'd cite the court to the first cement kiln case, the second national lime case, 233 F3rd at 633. None of the reopener arguments appeared in the petitioner's opening brief. As for the sort of the more substantive reopener argument about whether the reopener standard was met, assuming that the court should even address it, the fact that petitioners could have anticipated this change is not the only reason that the reopener standard isn't met. If you look at the only case where the court granted reopener recently, which is the startup shutdown malfunction case from 2008, you'll see that the court found a very, very tight connection between what EPA did and what was eventually reached in the case. That is, EPA actually eliminated enforceable regulatory text that it had expressly designed to control the startup shutdown malfunction, and the record showed all that. EPA eliminated that text, and that was the change, and it found that the text that it had changed was essentially inextricably intertwined with the exemption itself. None of that is here. EPA uses the pollutant by pollutant approach in every MAC standard it's ever issued, over 100 112 standards and all of the Section 129 standards. It's never used a different approach. So clearly, the particular floors that EPA ended up with in the 1997 rule or the rule that just came out are not tied to that pollutant by pollutant approach by any means. Getting to the substance, again, assuming the court should reach it, getting to the substance of their statutory argument, our position is that not only did the statute allow EPA to do it, to interpret the act the way it did here, it actually required that interpretation. If you look at the structure and context of the floor language, the most important thing is, at first, is the tie to Section 1, between the floor language in Section 129A2 and 129A4's requirement for specific individual standards. That is, Section 129A2 expressly refers to Section 129A4. It says set standards that reflect the maximum achievable degree of reduction in the pollutants that Section 129A4 lists. Section 129A4 then says you have to set individual standards for each of the following nine pollutants. And, of course, each one of those individual standards has to fully satisfy the stringency requirements in Section 129A2. So when EPA sets floors under this statutory provision, it's not setting one floor or one MAC standard for all of the pollutants at once, as the petitioners imply in their brief. It's setting standards one at a time, and it's determining the floors in the context of asking what's best achieved for this pollutant and en route to deciding what is the maximum achievable degree of reduction in this pollutant. There's another big problem with petitioner's interpretation, which is the only one that anyone has ever offered. That's that they take one of the clearest provisions of this very specific, very carefully tailored statutory provision and turn it into mush. What they don't mention, or what is very clear, is that under their interpretation, EPA is faced with the impossible task of trying to find out which units are performing best with respect to nine different pollutants at once. EPA has said it has no idea how that would be done. Petitioners have supplied no clue as to how that might be done. So you have two different readings here. You have EPA's, where Congress made it very clear that EPA is supposed to look at the units that are best for the pollutant that it's actually setting a standard for at that time. And you have petitioners, which asked EPA to somehow guess at which are best based on some subjective judgment about all the pollutants at once. In fact, and that's sort of a textual problem with their argument, there's also a very big practical problem. It's undisputed that the best performers for one pollutant could be the worst for others. So if EPA took this if this approach were taken to its logical extreme, EPA could just choose to base floors on, say, the units that are best for particulate matter, because it thinks that particulate matter is the most important pollutant. Those units could be the worst for mercury. Now, someone might say that's arbitrary, but there would be nothing in the statute that would prevent it. So what do you end up with? Floors that actually reflect the worst performers for mercury, and that's exactly the opposite.
It would not only not necessarily be arbitrary, it would seem to be compelled by that approach that there could be such a result as what you're describing.
I think you could certainly end up with that result.
Okay. That is your time, so unless my colleagues have questions, we'll hear once again from Mr. Wigmore on behalf of the petitioner.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I just didn't hear the time that I have remaining. 2 minutes for rebuttal?
You got 2 minutes.
Okay. Let me just address some of the issues that that first Mr. Rosen raised, and a question by Judge Ginsburg, whether or not Section 111 provides the authority to do MACT on MACT, and it explicitly does not do so, because Section 111 standards, you have to consider costs, energy requirements. This is in 111A1. Costs, energy requirements, and non-air quality health and environmental requirements. So it is explicit.
That's the provision you want them to use.
That's right.
Okay.
So when Mr. Rose said it does provide the authority, it explicitly does not. The only authority for setting the floors here is under 129A2. And Mr. Rosen also made some arguments that you know, based on EPA's methodology, you know, some units don't have far to go. They might be able to add on additional controls. They might be able to do waste segregation. That's all beyond the floor approach, and you have to consider those statutory factors in doing that. It's not what has been achieved. It's an argument that what he believes units could achieve. On the issue of the jurisdiction, 307B limits review of actions. The action here is the promulgation of the standard. There's nothing in the statute, and the EPA cites no case, to say that it limits, quote, approaches that the EPA use. And when EPA repromulgates the standard, that's the action we are challenging, and it relied on its pollutant-by-pollutant approach to do so. Let me say also, the sea change here was the BRCMAC case. Up until BRCMAC, every case, National Lime, Sierra Club, CKRC, BRCMAC, EPA argued that the floors themselves had to be achievable. And because of that, we agree that a pollutant-by-pollutant approach can be used for looking at an achievable standard, but not for what is achieved in practice, as the floor requires. Finally, with respect to Mr. Rosen misspoke, there are no new units that meet the new floor standard. The EPA claims that there are 7 units that meet the existing source floors, although 3 of those two of those units are the new units that resulted in the MACT on MACT. And none of these units has ever achieved the standard simultaneously.
We're actually beyond your time. So again, unless my colleagues have questions, seeing none, the case will be submitted, and we'll take a brief recess.
Really, yeah.